Welcome back to the Free From Wall Street podcast. This is Steven Libman. I have a special replay. Take a listen. Let me know what you think. And don't forget to go to integrityhg.com. Sign up for the Investor Club so you can see all the deals that we have in our pipeline and what we have done in the past. Welcome to the Free From Wall Street podcast, where we share how we have done over $200 million in real estate deals to create, preserve, and pass on generational wealth without the roller coaster ride of the stock market. If you're ready to start investing with purpose, visit freefromwallstreet.com. But for now, let's dive into this episode.
Welcome, Mindful Multifamily listeners. I am your host, Chris Salerno. Very excited to have you guys here today with us. Go ahead and get that notepad aside. Get ready for these golden nuggets because you're going to learn a lot from my friend Steven. Him and I go way back. We always chat about real estate. He's a wealth of knowledge. Started out in the single family world just like myself and then moved over to multifamily. So you are going to learn a lot. So sit aside, strap in, and get ready. Steven, thanks so much for being on the show.
Chris, always good to see you. Thank you so much for having me on. These are always fun conversations. Let's drop some bombs.
Let's do it. Looks like those shelves are empty. You're moving, aren't you?
Brother, I am living amongst boxes.
Oh, we've all done that. The truck is coming.
Here it is, imminent.
We'll touch on that in a little bit throughout the show. But a little bit about Steven. He graduated from Boston University in 2004, spent over 10 years in the real estate industry, first as a broker for several years, and then as an investor. Steven endeavors to partner with growth-oriented, like-minded partners and investors to assist them in achieving their goals of passive income and generating wealth creation. Steven started investing as one of the managing partners of a residential investment firm based in New Jersey, which became one of the largest private investment companies in the state, doing over $50 million in transactions and over 150 deals a year. Ooh. Now, Integrity Holding Group acquires institutional-grade commercial real estate investments in self-storage and multifamily, owning over $150 million assets under management. Steven and his bride, Grace, were married in 2007, right there before the crash. I'm going to bring a question up about that and delighted their two daughters, Cadence and Harper, and a son, Noah. Steven's an active member and sits on the board of their church and sits on the Rutgers Advisory Board of Design Thinking and has been published in Forbes multiple times. Well, thank you again, Steven, for being on the show. Always very excited, and I love talking to you because I always learn something from our conversation, no matter what it is. And so I always like to ask this question, this little icebreaker to get things started. How did you even get it started into real estate and then multifamily?
Yeah, so I was commuting into Manhattan doing sales jobs right out of college and realized that spending a month a year on a bus wasn't for me. Ugh. So I came home, I started doing mortgages, and then my sister-in-law, after I was married, opened up a real estate brokerage. So I was an agent, and then I became a broker, and I was sourcing deals, flips, and for investors. And after seeing a couple of those deals, I have this one investor who I still thank to this day for giving me the violent shove into kind of my path to success.
Well, I love it. Because
we went to the closing table, and an investor that I found a deal for, I made him probably a net $1 million that year in finding him good deals to flip.
I've done that before, working for someone else. I did my calculations, and then that's when I said, I am out.
Right.
There's no more of this.
So I make this guy a good return on his investment by sourcing him deals. And at the closing table, there was a pool ladder that was removed from the pool. And it was about $400. And he forced us to take it out of our commission at the closing table.
No way.
And I said, you know what? I think I could do this myself. We did. So we started a wholesale and flip company, and we did that for a bunch of years. Realized through that journey that that is a very transactional job. It pays you once.
You're hustling all the time.
Constantly trying to close the next deal, and then you're getting crushed in taxes because your ordinary income is taxed at ordinary income tax rates. So
that is right.
The move to multifamily came from recognizing that, hey, you know, we're making good money right now, but half of it or 40% of it is going to federal and state taxes. That's not how you build generational wealth. So,
all right.
So we started looking at some mentors that were doing bigger deals, more multifamily type things. I mean, at first we were in the single family business. So we thought, hey, maybe we just buy a bunch of single families and rent them out.
There you go.
Talked to a couple people that did that. Seemed like more work than I wanted to do. Then started talking to some folks in the multifamily space. And consistently we were hearing that, you know, the economies of scale of properties over 100 units would satisfy kind of what we were looking to do in that passive income place. And then you start reading books like Tax-Free Wealth by Tom Wheelwright, and you start recognizing I can make all this money and not pay taxes on it. So that was it for us. We got bit by the multifamily bug.
I love it. I love it. And so getting into multifamily, let's talk about that first transaction. You know, a lot of people are leaving the single family space, or, you know, maybe they're not leaving it and they're just like, they're so hesitant. And that happens in all of, a lot of entrepreneurs are hesitant to take action. So what was that first action that you took to actually land and close that large multifamily deal?
Well, so we were raising money for the single family space, right? Yeah. We had private investors that were investing with us in smaller single family housing, and I knew that we could convert them to come with us onto a larger project. We knew that the hurdle that we'd have to overcome, though, is we didn't have the experience operating those. Mm. So, you know, we said, let's go find an operator that needs money, and there let's partner with them, and we can kind of learn from the inside of that deal. So I think a lot of people's first deal when they move from single to commercial is they vary in size, but ours was 1,193 unit ground up self-storage development deal managed by CubeSmart, 14 acres, $11.5 million, $4 million capital raise. And we like to jump and grow wings on the way down. We were confident that we could do it, but it was a big, kind of shot out of the cannon for our first deal.
I love it. I love it. Let's talk a little bit about that self-storage. I like self-storage. I'm hearing I was actually listening to a talk show, and I heard that California has mandated a no eviction memorandum for self-storage, and the northern states, speaking of New York, is doing the same thing. Where do you see self-storage going in 2021? There's a lot of building going on with self-storage. What are your thoughts on that type of asset class?
Well, so a couple things to unpack there. First of all, we don't invest in New York, New Jersey, or California, as I think most smart investors don't.
Smart decision.
You know, so yeah, I can see that stuff happening there. That's why we don't own anything here. We have 300,000 plus square feet of rentable in and around Florida in the Orlando area. So we have three complexes now. So we like the metrics of it. You know, ground up development is a little bit trickier because you have to watch for other competition coming out of the ground and, you know, kind of hurting your lease up space. But self-storage, historically recession resistant, probably one of the better asset classes that you can be in for long-term holds. In 2007, 2008, during the last downturn, it was the only asset class to actually increase in value by 5% year over year through the downturn.
Love it.
So it's got very strong fundamentals, and we like the asset class a lot. You just have to know what you're doing in terms of underwriting. And, you know, we like to say that we invest in free states where, you know, the government doesn't have a ton of overreach and tell you how to run your business. So we try to look for population growth, economic growth, job density, and job diversity while looking for the same. It's kind of similar metrics than multifamily, right, that we're looking for in self-storage. So I think it's going to be very strong. I think there is more competition coming out of the ground, and I think you have to be more aware of that because there's only a certain saturation point. But if you find the right location and you find the right competitive environment, then I think you do well.
Yeah, no, very much so. And that's definitely in every asset class. You got to find that edge, that niche to separate yourself. Well said, my friend. So getting into the multifamily space, where do you see COVID affecting it with the current assets you have and then with assets that you are acquiring? I know you have a couple in Florida that you're looking at under contract with. And so where do you see on how their performance has been during COVID and then coming out in 2021?
So across the board, right, across the portfolio, we're seeing some dip in economic occupancy. We're seeing that really in every market. And it really depends on the class of asset, right? Yeah. Class C assets tend to be getting hit a little bit harder than the Class B assets. So we're working with our tenants really to find the government money that's out there for assistance, because we're not looking to evict necessarily every tenant, especially if it's COVID related, you can't. So, you know, we have to try to help get them to the right resources to help keep our assets stable, keep people paying while also keeping them housed. So, you know, the last 12 months has been a learning curve for a lot of us, because there's things that you have to look out for in terms of the tenant base. I think lease audits and tenant audits on what industries they're in directly is in direct proportion as to your economic occupancy. You know, so we were doing some heavy lifts and some turns that we were buying and doing like a 84 unit turn, and COVID slowed that process down, frankly, because you can't turn those tenants yet. Yeah. So I think with a lot of operators, they're going to see some adjustments to their pro forma. I think after this year, once world starts getting back to normal, we'll see maybe just a pause button on pro formas for a couple of months and then get back to where it needs to be. But overall, you know, what we're doing to insulate ourselves from that kind of, how do we de-risk the assets against things like COVID? It's all a learning curve while you're going through it. This hasn't happened before, at least to us. You know, so our next project is we're looking at existing cash flow. We're not looking to do heavy lifts. We're not looking to do bridges into perms. Like, I'm looking for 10-year debt, stable Class B assets that are just bigger, cash flowing, institutional grade, where the operator or the co-sponsor that we bring in is going to have that expertise that's been through a couple of market cycles already, that has gone through the ups and the downs and know how to manage against those things. So, you know, I think there's some ways to de-risk it, but I think new operators especially have to be careful going into this environment because, you know, frankly, we bought some assets last year that it looked good on paper until we got in. And I mean, this is the problem with the commercial world, right? There's not a lot of audited financials on these.
There's not.
To $20 million assets.
Yeah. So no, I agree.
If you don't have those audited financials, then you're not really looking at maybe real numbers, right? You kind of have to take the seller's word for it.
Yeah, so, no, very much so.
Underwriting is just a big deal this year and every year, but especially now.
Super. That recent deal that we closed, I'm thankful that we have a very conservative underwriter because we closed the property with 8 vacant units. Well, after we did our unit walkthroughs, because every property we acquire, we do our own every single unit walkthrough and prior to takeover. And we found out there's 18. Thankfully, we had a very aggressive property manager, and we're now running at like 96% occupancy. So we were able to bounce back very quickly, but you know, you definitely have to be very careful and underwrite for issues like that because you just never know. You hope the seller is a great person, but you never know.
Thank you so much for listening to the Free from Wall Street podcast. We're excited that you're listening and tuning in every week, but we want to have a two-way conversation with you, not just a one-way conversation. So go to integrityhg.com/webinar and join us on one of our weekly webinars where you can meet me, meet the team, have a conversation, and let's really talk about your investing goals and how we can help.
Let's roll that into our next question. When it comes to underwriting, what are you looking at? What are you underwriting to be conservative? And then what are you underwriting to be semi-aggressive? Because as you know, this market's very hot, very attractive. Here in the Carolinas, very competitive. So you always have to have an edge on underwriting because it always comes down to the numbers. So what are you guys doing differently? One, to be conservative, and then two, to be semi-aggressive.
So a couple things. One is we're underwriting for flat appreciation, rental appreciation for the first 24 months of an acquired asset. You know, I think right now you're seeing a lot of 2 and 3% rental bumps out of the gate for the next 5 years. I think COVID's going to put a pause on that. So we're underwriting flat for 24 months and then going up after that. Unless, of course, it's significantly below market, then we're just not writing in the rental appreciation for the first 2 years. We're just getting it up to market. So I think that's one way that we're trying to be conservative. I mean, we're really not banking on the market, right? We're looking at flat, if not increased cap rates by a point by the exit. I think most of us probably do that because, you know, projections are just that. know, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know what it looks like. We don't know where interest rates necessarily are going to go, and that will drive cap rate compression or expansion. So we try to stay relatively flat, if not increase the exit caps. And then our investors are a little bit different. You know, they're looking for specifically preferred returns. Mm-hmm. So they get more consistent yield with less upside. And that's the type of deals that we do, is more consistency in the portfolio.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And it's always good, like I said earlier, talking to you, because the learning from you on what you're doing in this market, as you're well experienced and well knowledgeable about it. When it comes to markets in general, I know you're loving the Florida market. What are some markets that are really on your radar that you guys are really attacking?
So right now we have some stuff in Orlando. We're under contract in Daytona Beach, Florida. We have a couple assets in Columbus, Ohio, and just outside the DFW market. So where people are moving to, where jobs are growing to, where the money's going, that's where we go.
Very nice. Very nice.
But it puts us in very competitive markets, right? Like you, right? I mean, if you're in the Charlotte MSA, you're fighting tooth and nail for a deal. So, you know, it really comes down to relationship. You know, those off-market deals that come from relationship, that, you know, you can't wait for a market to go on or a deal to go on the market and then fight with a real estate investment trust to get it. It's got to be.
I agree. Or a REIT who wants to hold it for, you know, 10 to 15 years and they don't care what the IRR is as long as it cash flows for them.
Yep.
You know, it's very important to stay on top of that. I agree. And so those markets that you're focused on, are those the same markets you're looking at with self-storage as well?
So Orlando is all self-storage. We don't own any multifamily there. It's one of those markets that you kind of get priced out.
Because
especially with our yields that we're looking for cash flow as well. So to find that cash on cash yield of, you know, 8-9%, it's difficult to find in these larger MSAs. But Daytona Beach, you know, we have that in the Daytona Beach property. We have that in the Dallas-Fort Worth property. And all of our Columbus deals are also cash flowing multifamily that hit those metrics too. So it's really more about population growth and upside and expansion, gentrification, and making sure that we're hitting our cash on cash yields.
Yeah, very much so. Let's talk about 07 when you got married. It was a very tough time for a lot of people. Congratulations. That was a very exciting time for you, I'm sure, but also a very tough time with the market crash. Where were you? Were you getting into real estate? Tell me a little bit about that time period and your thought process and your mindset through it.
Yeah, so the first year of marriage, I did, you know, normal W-2 type jobs. And then we got into, probably the year after that was when I got into real estate. So 2008, 2009, 2010 was really when I got into real estate. But like I said, I was working for investors trying to find good deals. So learning how to underwrite and find foreclosures in that time frame, we crushed it.
Oh, I believe it.
So it was good, because we weren't trying to work with the wrong audience during that time, right?
Correct.
The market dropped, and we had the opportunity to work with investors. My sister-in-law, who ran the firm that I was with at the time, she specifically focused on REOs. So we had, you know, national relationships with REO brokers or REO providers, and we were the REO broker for it. So we sold a lot of those things in-house to in-house investors. And so we did well. It was during the downturn. It was a scary time, but we did okay.
I love it. Well, that's you know, it's a great time for you. Like I said, congratulations on getting married. But you were able to take advantage of it and focus to build your knowledge and underwriting on the single family foreclosure markets, and then pivoting that into the multifamily industry.
Yeah, so, 100%.
Good. So so where do you think things are going to go when it comes to multifamily? Interest rates are rising. What's your 6-12 months view into the next year?
I mean, we're bullish, you know. I mean, we're bullish in multifamily regardless of the market. Long-term generational wealth is built, I think, through these types of properties. Your underwriting metrics will have to change with, you know, cap rate compression or expansion, or interest rate compression or expansion. But if you look at the metrics over the next 6 to 12 months, I don't see a big change. There's a shortage in housing. There is a shortage in especially affordable apartment housing.
Oh yeah.
So, you know, getting involved in these class B and C assets, regardless of the history, you know, you're looking at a pretty stable asset class. The reason that we don't invest in Wall Street is because we're anti-volatility. So if we're anti-volatility, what are we getting into? Things that have pretty strong metrics. So, you know, I think we just have to be careful in terms of how we're underwriting things, not changing our underwriting because of the competitiveness of the market. Mm-hmm. I think it's easy to do because, you know, you can slide a number up here, slide a number down here to make sure that your numbers fit your pro forma because it's competitive. As long as you're not doing that, I think you keep you and your investors safe.
100%. Nope. Well said. I couldn't say that any better. Where are you moving to? I know. I see these pictures of the beach and everything. Where are you moving from? Let everybody know where you're moving from, where you're moving to, and why you're moving there.
Yeah, so I live in central New Jersey now. The political and economic climate here as a business owner becomes untenable. So we've been looking for a while. We have a big base here, right? Our family's here. My wife is the youngest of seven. My son is the 31st grandchild.
And we all live in the same. He has some fighting to do. 31.
But, you know, it's been incredible to just kind of see how God laid it out for us, right? We went down to Hilton Head, which is my first time, by the way. If you haven't
been, Hilton Head's beautiful.
Unbelievable. So we went down there. We got a free week vacation from somebody with a timeshare down in Hilton Head the week before Christmas this year. Went down there, spent a week, found a house, pulled the trigger. And
Well, that means you're going to be closer to me, and you have to come through Charlotte to get
to Hilton
Head.
It's only 4 hours.
There we go.
A four-hour motorcycle ride, and I'll be out there.
Oh, there we go. Now we're going to be best friends now. You're coming in my neck of the woods.
I'm excited.
I love it.
So we're moving down to not on the island proper, but just over the bridge into a town called Bluffton. Really excited to start down there. You know, it's the snow just melted here 2 weeks ago, and I have friends that are down there that have not stopped playing golf all year. The beaches are open right now. It's March 4th. People are swimming. It's a different world. So we're excited to spend a lot more time outside, especially with the kids. I have a 7-year-old, 3-year-old, 1-year-old that's got to get them out of the house.
They're going to love it. And, you know, here in Charlotte, right now it's 70 degrees and it's just beautiful. I know at the beach, so they're going to enjoy it and you're going to have some good rounds of golf.
Yeah, for sure.
So that'll be good. Wonderful. Well, let's wrap things up with the path to success, Ron. You gave us a wealth of knowledge when it comes to storage, multifamily. Let's wrap things up with that path to success, Ron. Are you ready for it?
I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right. One book that you'd recommend.
Oh, if I had to whittle it down to one, it would be the Bible.
Yeah,
but I think you probably get a lot of those, that answer. So I'd follow it up with Never Split the Difference. If there's ever a book,
great book
based on negotiation and communication in general, I think Never Split the Difference would be the business book I would recommend.
I love it. A situation you overcame with having a strong mindset and a great business decision.
Well, I love Calvin Coolidge's quote about persistence, right? It's just nothing beats persistence, right? Talent doesn't, smarts doesn't. Like, so look up that quote. It's one of my favorites. And I think you can overcome any business problem that you have with persistence, you know? Yep. So we've run into a couple of different things where really just having the fortitude to forge through is what made all the difference. I mean, you just can't give up in this business. You have to.
I agree.
And anybody that tells you that they haven't encountered problems in their business isn't telling you the truth, right?
Yep.
So most of our investors, when they're interviewing us, they like to ask us similar questions like, hey, what was a situation where you just needed to pivot and figure out what to do and how'd you overcome that? I'll give you a quick example. Right now we're doing we purchased a 66 unit a couple years back in Columbus. It was too small of a deal. We kind of knew it was in, you know, too rough of an area. We kind of knew it. But we were buying it from the broker in the area, and we knew that it would be kind of a feeder deal into that area, and we really liked the market. So we went against advice. We went against our mentor's advice, and we went in there, and we just started fighting through the deal. And we found some worse tenants than we thought. We found some worse economics than we thought. And frankly, it was a heavier lift than we thought we had to do. And our asset management and property management skills were not up to par yet, right? We were still figuring out how to create an asset management business plan. And on a smaller asset like this, being, you know, 600 miles away, it was a challenge to figure out how to effectively property manage this thing. So, you know, we just kept forward with the business plan. We kept spending money in the right places. We kept turning the tenants through COVID, you know, tough time evicting people, but we finally got it turned and now we're on the upshot and we just actually got approached with an offer that we're going to go under contract with, that will actually exceed pro forma projections based on what we thought we would be able to buy and sell it for. And we pivoted our business plan by selling it, right? We're not going to hold this thing for 5 years when we recognize that it wasn't what we thought it was going to be and that area wasn't gentrifying as fast. So, you know, you learn from it and we'll move on.
I love it. I love it. But you were able to take an opportunity, a negative opportunity, and turn it into a positive. Knock on wood. Let's make sure it closes.
That's right.
Best business decision/deal you've ever accomplished.
I mean, I think this is very recent. You know, we've recently said because of that experience that we're not going to be the operator, right? What we're really good at is investor relationships. So we're going to focus on the capital. We're going to focus on our investors and we're going to seek out institutional sponsors. And what that means is we're basically becoming a private equity fund that is going to fund the best operators in the industry.
I love it. I love it. One way you like to give back to the world.
Well, this is the crux of the business and we won't spend too much time on it, but the entire heart behind the business is to invest with purpose.
Yes.
And we carve out a percentage of every single deal for a 501c3 nonprofit in every single deal that we do. So we're big into impact investing. We think that, you know, you can move from success to significance by doing this. There's no shortage of need in the world, and we're trying to capitalize on these deals to fulfill that need on a deal-by-deal basis. We want to create passive income for not just ourselves and our investors, but also for nonprofits. They're the ones fighting the fight on the front lines, and then they have to come home and fundraise. We just want to take that need away.
I love it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. Stephen with a wealth of knowledge and a ton of golden nuggets. Don't forget to leave it down in the reviews and go ahead and comment of what your golden nugget was that you took away from this episode. Stephen, if someone wants to invest alongside of you to help these causes, to partner with you, to buy these assets, how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so if you go to integrityhg.com, you can join our investor club there and you'll get on our newsletter. You'll start seeing some of the deals that we're doing, see some historic deals that we've done, and then we'll just get to know each other.
Yeah, I love it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you have it. I hope everyone is staying safe and I'll see you guys next time. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for listening to the Free From Wall Street podcast. If you like what you hear, leave us a rating and review and let us know what you think.